Yeah.
The government says one way to contain inflation is to suppress wages. Prices are going up, but incomes are not keeping up. That has meant sweeping rail strikes over demands for higher pay. Some public sector workers, such as teachers and medics, have received a pay rise, but below the inflation rate.
These are tough times for everybody, but it's those on the lowest incomes who are feeling the pinch. According to one study, more than 4 million, that's one in six British households, are worse off now than they were last year, a number that could change come the cold season. Saeed Purizab, London.
Illegal and politically motivated. That's how angry protesters describe a Swedish court ruling sentencing Iranian national Hamid Nouri of life in jail over participating in killing imprisoned dissidents. Nouri is a former judiciary staff who has been convicted by the Stockholm District Court on July 14th of taking part in the 1988 execution of members of the anti-Iran terror group Mujahideen-e-Khalq organization, while he served as an assistant to the deputy prosecutor at the Gohardasht prison outside the Iranian city of Karaj. Protesters here warn that the Swedish verdict has sent negative signals to Iranians.
We gathered outside the Swedish embassy today to demand an end to Sweden's circus trial of Hamid Nouri.
Sweden has no jurisdiction to rule on a case that's considered a domestic issue in Iran. Besides, all of the witnesses who testified against Mr. Nouri were members of a terror group and have never seen Nouri in person in Iran.
The accusations were leveled against Nouri by members of the Mujahideen-e-Khalq terror group, or MKO. Protesters here say the MKO itself has committed countless war crimes, from aiding former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s Iran-Iraq war to the serial killings of Iranian statesmen and civilians in the early years after the 1979 Islamic Revolution. The MKO was on the U.S. and EU's blacklist of terrorist organizations before both countries delisted the group in 2012 and 2009, respectively.
The MKO have the blood of at least 12,000 Iranians on their hands. They have no position amongst Iranians, and we call them the hypocrites here in Iran. So I want to tell the Swedish prosecutor that a ruling is tantamount to approving the crimes committed by MKO terrorists against Iranians.
Iran says Hamid Nouri has for the past 32 months been kept in abysmal conditions in a solitary confinement in Sweden. Hamid Nouri was arrested upon arrival in Sweden at Stockholm Airport in 2019 and was immediately imprisoned. A life sentence in Sweden generally means a minimum of 20 to 25 years in prison. Nouri can appeal the verdict.
Protesters here called the whole shebang as a political game aimed at smearing the Islamic Republic's justice system. They described the Swedish ruling as rabble-rousing, which whitewashes terrorism and gives a green light to the ill intentions of the MKO against Iranians. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iran's flagship carrier, Iranair, has returned to Rome from July 14. A new deal recently signed between Iranian and Italian aviation authorities has revived the route connecting Tehran and Italy's capital, Rome. The deal is a revised version of previous aviation cooperation agreement, which stresses the importance of increased flights between the two countries to help boost economic ties and tourism.
Io già andai in Iran 20 anni fa.
I visited Iran 20 years ago, and I've been thrilled about that trip. I'm going again with a group of friends in September, and we're all very excited.
There has certainly been a more intense dialogue between Italy and Iran lately, and this is extremely positive. Having said that, we are still facing enormous difficulties due to the sanctions. However, we are confident that more European routes will be added by Iran Air in the future.
Iran Air, which has been flying to Italy for 55 years, also operates flights to the business-focused city of Milan in the north of the country. Aviation ties between Iran and Italy took a hit in 2018 when the US unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Washington's withdrawal was followed by a wave of anti-Iran sanctions by the US.
I hope this resumption of the Tehran-Rome route will bode well for another resumption, that of the JCPOA, from which the U.S. unilaterally withdrew in 2018. It would be really important for tourism and commerce that flight connections between Iranian and European cities are established.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian traveled to Rome last week to meet his Italian counterpart and discuss the latest geopolitical developments across the globe. During that visit, Iran's top diplomat also met with tens of Italian industrialists and businessmen who showed a strong interest in cooperating with Tehran. Max Civili, Rome.
As temperatures in Britain soar, the race for the next Conservative Party leader is also heating up. Following further eliminations, now only three candidates remain. On Monday, Tom Tugendhat was eliminated during the third round vote, whilst Kemi Badenoch went out in the fourth. Rishi Sunak remains in the lead. Penny Mordaunt is close in second place, followed by Liz Truss. However, as the fight intensifies, things are turning bitter, with attacks on policy, along with accusations of ideological treachery, leading to candidates refusing to appear on future televised debates. Pundits believe the divisive race has exposed deep-rooted splits in the ruling party at a time when Britain faces numerous economic crises.
A senior Conservative journalist said to me that he found the entire leadership campaign wholly depressing. He thinks that it's been a competition to be negative. He thinks it's a race to the bottom in terms of showing what's wrong with the others rather than what's right with themselves. And crucially, we see a party divided. It seems to me that the Conservatives are going through an identity crisis, perhaps partly caused by Boris Johnson, who was a populist, without a very clear philosophy. Now, the next leader has to refocus the Conservatives on its more traditional values.
There can be little doubt in Rishi Sunak achieving a place in the final round, as he only requires five more supporters in order to achieve that place. However, the real battle will be over who joins him in second place. Two candidates will last into the final round, and then, of course, it goes to the votes from the Tory party membership to decide who the next leader of the party, and therefore the country, will be. Robert Carter, London.
During a joint press conference, which followed the latest round of their Astana process talks, Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi welcomed the Russian and Turkish presidents, along with their accompanying delegations, to the summit. Raisi stressed the need to protect the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Syria, as well as the importance of the fight against terrorism.
Discussions focused on the sovereignty of Syria and the territorial integrity of the country, emphasizing that the Syrian government must rule over all parts of the country and that the presence of Americans on the eastern banks of the Euphrates is not acceptable and they must withdraw and all parts of the country must be governed by the legitimate government. We all emphasize that we should combat terrorism and there is the need to do so and there is also a need for cooperation among all states. Today, terrorist currents have jeopardized the security of the region. The all-out fight against terrorism by the Islamic Republic of Iran was a successful experience. I commemorate Lieutenant General Soleimani as the icon of resistance and combating terrorism. All countries have fought against terrorism, but today there are concerns about the presence of terrorists in Syria. So there is a need for firm results to be achieved by all states that participate in the fight against terrorism.
Russian President Vladimir Putin echoed similar remarks and highlighted the importance of the Astana process.
Agreed. In order to normalize the situation in Syria, all three countries have agreed that full settlement of the conflict is only possible through political means and holding talks based on UNSC Resolution 2254. And while observing the basic principle of sovereignty and territorial integrity and unity of Syria, all these principles must be respected and the future of Syria must be dictated by its own people and nothing should be dictated from the outside.
Putin added that all sides have called for the continuation of the fight against terrorism and extremism so that such threats will be eliminated. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, while echoing the remarks made by his counterparts, also pointed out the importance of finding a sustainable political solution to the Syrian situation.
The city of Severodonetsk lies mostly in ruins. It was the scene of some of the fiercest fighting between the two armies. It now resembles a post-apocalyptic wasteland. At a military base, a pro-Russian fighter pulls down a Ukrainian sign. What's left of the city is now in Russian hands. On the outskirts of town, a grain silo. Russia and Ukraine blame each other for bombing it. Now, that may well be one of the most tragic places that I've been to in this war, because millions of people around the world may well go hungry due to this conflict because of the huge amounts of grain that Ukraine exports in usual times around the world. For those people, it won't really matter whether it was Russia or Ukraine who committed this strike. Humanity is bombing its own food supplies. Unsurprisingly, few people remain in the city. Those that do are keen to tell of what they saw.
The Ukrainians knew where people lived. They drove around looking for people's houses. And when they fled, they occupied their houses and started firing. We live in that house, and they were firing from there for 3 weeks.
It wasn't all done by Russia. It was done by Ukraine. There are witnesses who saw tanks driving up and firing at houses, just like that.
While NATO and Ukraine blame Russia for the devastation, the strange truth is that everyone I spoke to here is more critical of Ukraine.
Ukraine acted in a sly way. They would bring a howitzer here, fire, and then leave. Then Russia would strike, and they would say Russia is bombing civilians. They were occupying kindergartens and would fire from there.
They made them sit in the basement and took over their flats. They put mortars on the roofs and fired. We don't know what Russia did. We didn't see them until we returned.
While Russia and Ukraine continue to blame each other for the devastation wrought by this conflict, there remains little appetite for peace. The longer this war goes on, the more of Ukraine will be destroyed, and the greater the threat to world food supplies and the global economy. Jaromír Severodonetsk.
EU Foreign Affairs ministers held their last scheduled meeting on Monday before taking a six-week summer break. Of course, proceedings were dominated by the war in Ukraine.
Ukraine needs more arms. We will provide them. The war will continue. We'll continue supporting. And that's why I have proposed the next tranche of the European Peace Facility, allocating 500 million more.
Josep Borrell has doubled down on criticism of sanctions against Russia and their impact on EU citizens. He has even written a blog on the subject. It's reported he's doing this because of growing disquiet amongst EU leaders regarding the harm sanctions are causing. Energy and food prices continue to rise in the EU, placing enormous pressure on citizens. Experts warn things could get worse.
We have seen over the last couple of months that there is disparity, there is disunity. There is already an exception for Hungary in terms of energy supply. And my worry is that as soon as the winter sets in, that might be a problem, and then we have to see how long the support for the sanctions will materialise.
Ordinary citizens are asking why we don't hear more about peace negotiations.
The price you pay now is out of control. Gas, oil, electricity, food. It's all gone crazy. We need to end the war.
As the West continues to pump billions of euro and dollars into Ukraine, the country's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is sacking senior officials. Analysts say it shows the country remains corrupt at the highest levels. The European Commission will unveil much-anticipated plans on Wednesday, designed to ensure the EU doesn't run out of gas this winter. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The British capital is boiling, with July temperatures rarely seen in the country. For some, it's business as usual, a chance to bask in it. For others, a cause for concern.
I would say climate changing. Every year, it's just getting hotter and hotter. In other countries like Dubai and Kuwait, that's 50, 60 degrees. That's normal nowadays.
Basically, we let it go like downhill for like 200 years, for example. And now we just, we're doing something wrong here, you know. But at least the realization is a first step. So hopefully they will take it more serious and start actually doing something.
With temperatures climbing up to 41 degrees Celsius over the next 2 days, the National Meteorological Service has issued its first ever red warning for exceptional heat for much of the country.
Britain is a country where people are used to complaining about the wet weather. Now this scorching heat is going to give them something else to gripe about. But it doesn't stop there. There's real concern about how these rising temperatures will impact the everyday life.
Metro passengers have been urged not to travel by train. Schools are only allowing early pickups after the government said they had to stay open and that people should be resilient enough to enjoy the sunshine. Climate activists are threatening more decisive action to perceived inaction by government and big business, similar to the Extinction Rebellion protest that shut down parts of central London a few years ago. The activists' frustration now confirmed by the UK's climate minister, Alok Sharma, who has accused some of the candidates running for prime minister of being lukewarm on achieving the country's net zero target. And this week, his plea for climate action as he addressed the Petersburg climate dialogue in Berlin.
I have to say, and I say this with all sincerity, that many of the commitments that we heard in Glasgow remain just that. They are still just words on a page. And you know, because you can see this around you, all the evidence tells us that time is running out.
Climate scientists say the next decade will be defined by greater weather extremes. But the fear is it'll also be shaped by humanity's collective failure to do more. Syed Purizza, London.
Mashhad, a tourist magnet in northeast Iran. Every year, some 30 million pilgrims from across the Muslim world travel to Mashhad to visit the holy shrine of Imam Reza, the 8th Shia Imam. But a few miles away from the shrine, there's a whole new world for tourists who would also like to enjoy natural resorts after a spiritual journey. Welcome to Kuh Sangi, a heaven at the heart of Mashhad, as described by this Iraqi family.
We come from Iraq. We visited the holy shrine of Imam Reza, and then I found about this amazing place called Kuh Sangi and came with my family to enjoy the scenery.
It's my second trip to Mashhad. The city offers you a whole traveling package that includes pilgrimage and recreation.
Kuh Sangi is one of a myriad of attractions in Mashhad. Natural resorts such as Shandiz and Chali Dara Valley, and recreational centers such as Water Waves Land and Iram Amusement Park are among the must-see places in Mashhad. The city is also home to 10,000 historical sites. Only 1,500 of those sites have so far been registered and developed for tourists.
One of the major attractions of Mashhad is its restaurants and street eateries. Mashhad is the city of foods. It has numerous restaurants serving a variety of local and international foods. Mashhad also has more than 680 parks, providing a chance for visitors to entertain themselves besides their pilgrimage.
Mashhad is also a hotspot for health tourism in the region. Only in 2021, over 24,000 health tourists visited the city, mainly from Iraq and Oman, earning the city roughly $48 million. Authorities in Mashhad say the potentials are countless, but so are the challenges. To foreign visitors, Mashhad is still a religious-only city, and many are not aware of its recreational capacities.
We at the municipality are trying to raise awareness of the attractions in Mashhad. One of those efforts is the launching of the English version of our website, which guides foreign travelers through the city online. We will soon launch the Arabic webpage as well.
Due to the large number of visitors throughout the year, Mashhad has one of the best-equipped public transport systems in the country. It has a growing subway network and bus rapid transit system, beside other transportation services, making it easy to access the desired tourist destinations in the city.
Known as the spiritual capital of Iran, Mashhad seems to offer more than a spiritual experience to visitors. With its spectacular natural resorts and growing number of recreational centers, Mashhad municipality plans to turn the city into a tourist hub in the region. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Mashhad.
In the limelight.
As the U.S. Fed raises interest rates, dollar-denominated loans become an unsustainable burden to states around the globe. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Philip and Mann titled, "The U.S. Selfish War on Inflation Will Tip the World into Recession." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Later in July, U.S. interest rates are expected to jump for a second time this year, and that's going to wreck any chance of a global recovery. The Federal Reserve could push its base rate up by as much as a full percentage point, ending 15 years of ultra-cheap money intended to promote growth. This jump to a range of 2.5% to 2.75% would take the cost of borrowing money in the U.S. to more than double the Bank of England's 1.25%. And yet, the Fed could just be taking a breather as it contemplates even higher rates. Though this column is not about the U.S., it is concerned with the terrible impact on Britain and countries across the world of America's selfish disregard when it decides to tackle high inflation with higher borrowing costs. Britain is already feeling the effects of the Fed's pledge to tackle inflation until it is defeated, come what may. U.S. officials claim higher interest rates in the U.S. make it an attractive place for investors to store their money. But to take full advantage, investors must sell their own currency and buy dollars, sending the price of dollars rocketing higher. In July, the U.S. dollar increased in value against a basket of six major currencies to a 20-year high. The euro has slipped below parity with the dollar in the last few days. The pound, which has plunged by more than 10% this year to below $1.20, is losing value with every week that passes. In Japan, the central bank has come under huge pressure to act after the yen tumbled to its lowest level against the dollar since 1998. There are two important knock-on effects for those of Americans that live and work outside the U.S. The first is that goods and raw material priced in dollars are much more expensive, and most commodities are priced in dollars, including oil. Borrowing in dollars also becomes more expensive, and while getting a loan from a U.S. bank is beyond the average British household, companies do it all the time, and especially those in emerging economies where funds in their backyard can be in short supply. The Bank of England interest rate setter Catherine Mann recently said that her main motivation for wanting significant increases in the UK's lending rates was her fear that the widening gap with the dollar was pushing up import prices, and higher import prices meant higher inflation. If only she could persuade her colleagues on the bank's Monetary Policy Committee that the devaluation of the pound was a serious issue, maybe they would push up the bank's base rate rate in line with the Fed rate increases. After the Fed makes its move, more may join her. Until January this year, Britain's inflation surge was on the course to be short-lived. Now, it seems the Russian special operation in Ukraine and a splurge of untargeted handouts by the Biden administration during the coronavirus pandemic, which have served to push up prices in America, will keep inflation in the UK high into next year. Those governments that have borrowed in dollars face a double whammy. Not only will they need to raise domestic interest rates to limit the impact of import price rises, they will also face a massive jump in interest payments on their dollar borrowings. Emerging markets and many developing world countries will be broke when these extra costs are combined with a loss of tourism from the COVID pandemic. Sri Lanka has already gone bust, and many more could follow. Zambia's government borrowed heavily before the pandemic to become self-sufficient in electricity. It is a laudable aim, but has left the Central African state with a ratio of debt to national income much the same as France, about 110%. The problem for Zambia is not the same as for France, which pays an interest rate of 1.8% to finance its debts, measured by the yield on its 10-year bonds. The Zambian 10-year bond commands a rate of 27%. Now Zambia, like France and so many other countries, must borrow simply to live. To invest is to borrow more. There is no sign that the U.S. will change course. Joe Biden is in a panic about the midterm elections when fears of a spiraling inflation could favor the Republicans. This panic has spilled over to the Fed, which has adopted hysterical language to persuade consumers and businesses that higher rates are coming down the track and to curb their spending accordingly. Meanwhile, the price of oil rose on Monday, July 18th, after the U.S. President Joe Biden came away from talks in West Asia without an agreement on raising supply. Biden had hoped to secure a promise from Saudi Arabia to increase its output of oil, which could lead to an easing of global supply pressures. But Brent crude rose 2.6% to $103.88. After Saudi Arabia's Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud quelled speculation over an output increase. He said that officials at U.S.-Arab summit on Saturday, July 16th, did not discuss oil and that the OPEC oil cartel nations would continue to assess market conditions. Naeem Aslam, the chief market analyst at Ava Trade, said the message is that it is OPEC Plus that makes the oil supply decision and the cartel isn't remotely interested in what Biden is trying to achieve. He said OPEC Plus will continue to control oil supply and one country alone cannot determine the oil supply. At least that is the message that traders have taken from Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia. The increase in oil prices will keep up the pressure at the pumps, where drivers have faced record petrol and diesel prices. Prices have climbed so high that the government asked the Competition and Markets Authority to study the market, and its initial findings raised concerns over the margins made by refineries. Thus, the U.S. Fed knows inflation is a problem born of insufficient supply that only governments can take. But that doesn't look like stopping it from pushing the U.S. economy and everyone else's into recession.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The war in Ukraine is moving full steam ahead. One of the developments, energy warnings from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, who has said that a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch this winter awaits Europe due to the possibility of Russia cutting off gas supplies completely. Then there's a warning from the former Russian President Medvedev that an attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Meanwhile, several high-profile suspensions have taken place in Ukraine, while Russia is targeting Ukraine's missiles as Western-supplied weapons bite. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joins us from Moscow. Then we have the president of the European Institute for International Law and International Relations, Mahmoud Rafat, who joins us from Stockholm.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Fred Weir, let me first start with you. The former Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, has issued a warning that I thought would set the stage for this program, in which he said attack on Crimea will ignite, quote, Judgment Day response. Judgment Day will come very hard, very fast and hard. It will be very difficult to hide. Tell us, give us context of that and what he's talking about, what he means.
Well, I think the key here is the American threat to provide long-range missiles. They're providing these multiple launch missiles, you know, the HIMARS they're called, with shorter ranges, like 30 to up to 70 kilometers. But there is a version of this weapon system that has missiles that go up to 300 kilometers. And the Ukrainians have explicitly threatened to use them against Crimea. And Crimea is, besides its symbolic importance to Ukraine, it is a target-rich environment. It has the Russian naval base at Sevastopol and several key military zones. So I think this threat is something the Russians take pretty seriously. And I'm guessing that warning is directed, not directly, but symbolically at Washington. They're trying to tell the Americans, don't supply this type of weaponry to the Ukrainians because it will be a major escalation. Otherwise, I don't know what Judgment Day might mean. I mean, the Russians do have the ability to destroy a lot of targets inside Ukraine, and they are doing it. So, but Judgment Day is a religious term, and I don't really know what specific sort of escalation they're threatening. But it doesn't. It sounds chilling, that's for sure.
Mahmoud Rafat, I'll put it this into context as to how some have been reporting this, in which Medvedev was said not to elaborate but has previously warned the U.S., they've put it in this context, of the dangers of attempting to punish a nuclear power like Russia over its action in Ukraine. Do you think that the U.S. is pushing Russia's buttons to that point?
Well, obviously, the American side gave intelligence information about the places of the Russian generals, which caused killing 17 generals. And this started by direct orders or instructions from President Biden, which means, yes, there are somehow Americans pushing both Ukraine and Europeans against Russia, and not in a Russian way, because we have to also remember there is international law, and this international law gives Ukraine the right to join the NATO, but on the ground that not feasible, especially for the Russian side, which they consider a big threat to them, to the security, national security of Russia, and they would never admit it. So not only the international law will manage the case or the file in front of us today, but will be somehow powers who will talk in next few weeks, and we will see the escalation will arrive until which point if the American side continues supporting Kiev.
Well, not to just zoom in on this issue, but I think it's pretty important since we have opened up the program with it. And Fred Weir, I'm curious whether the U.S. has to discuss or get permission from other NATO members when it wants to, when it provides Ukraine with this HIMARS, what do you call it, a HIMARS missile system? Is that what it's called? Where it, as you said, has a 300-kilometer range? Because based on that, my next question then would be, what if one lands in Crimea, or two, or how many would it take for Russia to react? This is for Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The HIMARS system, it is one system, but it has different types of ammunition. They are already providing, the Americans are already providing these systems to Ukraine. They're already in action in the Donbass. Apparently there are a dozen or so of them already in Ukraine. But that type of ammunition, which is the high-end, the long-range missiles, are not yet being provided. And it would be, I think it would be a step beyond for the Americans to do so, except that we've already had this exchange of opinions. The Ukrainians have said, we will target Crimea, which we consider to be Ukrainian territory, not Russian. And the United States, officially, I haven't got the quote to hand, but they did officially say that they wouldn't consider Crimea to be Russian territory, because they have forbidden Ukrainians to use these weapons against Russian territory. But both the United States and Ukraine doesn't consider Crimea Russian territory. Therefore, I think some sort of fix is in, and that in Washington they are contemplating this very escalation. And it would be pretty serious, as that quote, that rather obscure, vague quote from Medvedev clearly implies, the Russians would regard that as a serious escalation, and they would react in some way. And we don't know what that would be, but, everything like this draws us a little closer to World War III than we would like to be.
Sure. Well, Mr. Rafat, on the political side, within Ukraine, there was a development that was pretty strange in the way it was first presented and then retracted, in a sense, where President Volodymyr Zelensky was reported first abruptly firing the head of Ukraine's powerful domestic security agency called the SBU, then the state prosecutor general. in which it cited dozens of cases actually of collaboration with Russia by officials in those agencies. But then the news came out that they have been suspended pending investigations, not formally dismissed. What do you make of that development?
Well, I think there is somehow a contradiction in the behavior of President Zelensky, because he fired the top officials of intelligence and the prosecutor as well, general prosecutor of Ukraine, because there, he accused them, or he said their employees are working for the Russian, which is considered enemy of Ukraine for the moment. While that cannot be applied on the ground, that cannot be imagined on the ground to happen, because these people, either they were blocked there, or they were imprisoned, or whatever we call their statute, but not working for Russian side. This is not imaginable even to work for the Russian side. But in my opinion, President Zelensky expected more investigation or more result of the war crimes and crimes against humanity, etc., of these chains of crimes the Kiev prosecution addressed to the Russian side. And both the intelligence service with the prosecution did not fulfill his wishes to gather as much as he wanted to present them to the International Criminal Court, or to start with other Western governments this case, the case of crimes, war crimes, and crimes against humanity they accuse Russia to had committed. In my opinion, this is the main reason, the failure of the two structures or two organizations to fulfill the wishes of President Zelensky in these cases.
How do you see that, Fred? I mean, you know, some are looking at this being maybe on a larger scale to happen, because as the war drags on, as the country is suffering as immensely as it is, that you're going to see more dissent, maybe in a sense, to happen in Ukraine. Do you see this as a sign of that?
I think it's a very worrisome.
No, this is Fred Weir. Go ahead, Fred Weir. I'm sorry.
It's extremely worrisome. It's not just the two top officials who've been suspended. They haven't been accused of treason, but there are ongoing almost 700 treason cases in Ukraine. And this is something Zelensky mentioned in his statement. There are 660 cases of treason within the state apparatus, the SBU, the military, other institutions. And there are 60 cases of officials in occupied territories who have gone to work for the Russians. This is totally believable, by the way. And I don't know about all the treason cases and so on. But you have a regime that is now clearly terrified of its own shadow. This scale of arrests for and treason charges is not a sign of a unified government in any way. So it's extremely worrisome, and it's the kind of thing that starts to get out of hand when you've got that many people clearly being suspected of treason and on trial, under arrest, and you've got police, secret police and others looking for such enemies. This kind of thing has a way of snowballing. It is really, really worrisome. I have no idea what is going on in Kiev, but people should be paying much closer attention to it.
Well, there's another point of concern for Ukraine, Mr. Rafat, and that is whether it's going to continue getting the support that it has been. And I'm going to put these two developments into one, forge it into one for you, where there's one piece of news that talks about what it termed EU fatigue, where the EU foreign policy chief, Joseph Borrell, actually had to make a statement saying some European leaders have been saying that the sanctions were an error, they were a mistake, in which he says, we don't think it was a mistake. And then you have the get-together of the foreign ministers just today to show that the bloc can maintain its financial and military support, pledging more support for Ukraine. Of course, this is as their own citizens are suffering. Do you think that there's fatigue within the EU countries for prolonging this war?
Well, for sure, there's a fatigue. We cannot know the exchange rate of the euro the euro for first time in its history to fall down in front of the dollar and to lose big percentage of its value and to become less than even $1 today after it was like $1.20. This is a big sign of fatigue of the economy as well. We mustn't forget the most important point that the industry of Europe is really threatened and seriously threatened because of the suspension of Russian gas. Meanwhile, Russia is a big market for the European products. So there are on several levels. But we need to understand at the same time the kind of relation between Europe and the United States since the Second World War. Since the end of the Second World War, Europe did not build an army. Europe did not build real independency of the United States protection system. So when we talk about the NATO, we talk about United States decision. And it's very clear the administration of President Biden is insisting to continue the war with any price, to be from the European side or from the Russian side. And the Europeans will not be able to get out of this dilemma as long as the President Biden administration still, and we still have 3 years for this administration. So as long as the administration Biden is there, the war, I think, we will not be able to stop it despite the fatigue and despite the consequences Europe is paying. We are feeling today worldwide, maybe, but in Europe in particular, the dramatic increase of prices, the threat of industries, as I just mentioned, to be stopped because of the gas, lots of things we have in Europe. But Europe will not be able to dispatch from the United States decision because of the nature of the relationship since the end of the Second World War in 1945 until today, and will continue like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it remains to be seen how much of this relationship is going to continue in its bond. Because when you have a warning coming from the IEA, for example, Fred Weir, where European nations, it said, must take urgent action to avert a potentially disastrous natural gas supply crunch. And the biggest one that I could think of, Fred Weir, is the one that was issued by Germany, where even the government said that, people have to maybe cope to turn to wood as a heating source for this winter. And plus, we know that Nord Stream 1 is actually under repair, where Russia now says, if we want to open it back up, we need to talk about lifting of sanctions. How worried should Europe be?
Yes, very worried. There's so many aspects of these sanctions that have boomeranged. But on the energy front, that is the biggest single, I don't know what you'd call it, goal or something that the West has inflicted. So it is remarkable that in the meeting you referenced today, they did not impose any new energy-related sanctions. It is clear that the winter is not that far away, and natural gas reservoirs are not anywhere near full, and therefore this is a problem that is focusing minds for sure right now. I don't know what this leads to. What I fear, to come back to your original question, I fear further escalations. Some news, you know how this happens. Some terrible thing happens, an atrocity, a huge war crime, something just comes up and completely changes the public atmosphere and ratchets up the confrontation. This is a very dangerous time, and it's not a static thing, this Ukraine fatigue or whatever. I think we're in the midst of a very fluid situation, one in which the standoff between Russia and the West can turn very nasty very quickly. And so I don't know, I wake up every morning in sheer terror of what I might find when I start reading the news.
So what's going to trigger that? I mean, since you spoke that way, what would trigger that World War III scenario?
Yeah, well, the Ukrainians attacking Crimea with heavy missiles and the Russians retaliating in some way. Because what could the Russians do? They could retaliate against the NATO staging grounds where they're bringing weaponry into Ukraine, right on the border there. It seems likely that in recent attacks, the Russians have killed foreign officers. I don't think this is well noticed, but an attack on an officers' club in Vinnytsia the other day appears to have killed foreign military officers who were there consulting with their Ukrainian colleagues. This sort of thing, where because NATO forces, especially Polish forces, are so much more involved in Ukraine and inside Ukraine, and on the border where weapons are being transported every day, you can easily get an attack where Russians will hit NATO forces, and we will find ourselves in the midst of a hot war.
Sure. Well, since our guest there is from Stockholm, Sweden, I'd like to ask you, in terms of the application made by Sweden and Finland, and what your thoughts are about their desire and eagerness to join NATO.
Of Sweden, honestly, it's an old desire. Maybe it was pushed up by the war now between Russia and Ukraine, but this desire existed, and there were lots of voices calling to join NATO, but that was not really priority in Sweden. We know Sweden did not get involved in any war since more than 200 years, since 1814, did not get involved in any war. So despite that, Sweden was somehow motivated to go to the NATO since, especially after the end of the Cold War, 1990 of last century. So this is all desire. But now I estimate it somehow came with rush. This step came with rush. Sweden would better to wait at least until the end of this year, because until today we do not know what is the limit of the escalation. Shall Russian side use a nuclear as threatened with, or it will limit its military action and military operation on what's running on the ground. Employing the pressures against a nuclear power must be managed differently, in my opinion. Russia is a nuclear power. You cannot put it under such pressure. So that's why we do not know the escalation will arrive to where. This is the point for the moment.